Hey, and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus and streaming live at kuci.org. Today is Wednesday, April 3rd, 2019. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. And my guest today for the entire hour is Meredith May. Meredith May spent 16 years at the San Francisco Chronicle, where her narrative reporting won the Penn USA Literary Award for Journalism and was shortlisted for the Pulitzer Prize. She's co-author of I, Who Did Not Die, and a fifth-generation beekeeper. She lives in San Francisco, where she keeps several hives in a community garden, and she's here today to primarily talk about her memoir, The Honey Bus, a memoir of loss, courage, and a girl saved by bees, published by Park Row Books, a division of HarperCollins. Hi, Meredith.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Can you hear me all right? I can. I'm so glad.
Okay.
I'm so glad to have you on the line. I loved your memoir, and I love honeybees and have my own experience with them, being afraid of them, getting over the fear of them. Your memoir goes so many places and so many things about bees I didn't know about. Let's first start, though, with you talking about how your memoir came about.
Sure. Well, I always knew I wanted to write about my family. You know, I'm a big memoir buff. I love The Tender Bar and Glass Castle and Liar's Club. And I felt that my family was unique in some ways and might make a similar story. But it really, the moment actually when it really hit me was I was at the San Francisco Chronicle, and an editor and I convinced our bosses to put two beehives on the roof on the busiest intersections in San Francisco. And the day the bees arrived in their cages and we were transferring them into their empty hives, I hadn't held bees in my hand since I was a kid. And so this was like 30 years had gone by. And when I held them and I felt their vibration in my palms and I smelled them and I heard their buzz, it was all like so familiar and so personal, I started weeping. And I think my coworkers must have thought I was nuts crying over bugs. And I thought, okay, wait a minute, that's interesting. I think that, you know, a memoir needs to have a higher level. It has to have something beyond this happened and this happened. And that's when I figured out what it was, what was the X factor.
Interesting. So, you know, we usually wait a while before the author reads, but I'd love to hear you read now. That will help us set up the story a bit. Could you do that?
Oh, yeah. I'd love to do that.
Okay.
I picked a section. It's the first time I saw the queen bee.
Okay.
The only thing you have to know, it starts with a quote. Grandpa has just handed me the bee smoker, and that's what we use. We smoke the bees to calm them down.
Okay. Yep.
Oh, hold on. Glasses will make this much better. There we go. Okay, smoke them, Grandpa said. I pointed the snout of the smoker over the remaining 9 frames in the hive and squeezed the folding bellows once. One white cloud puffed out. Keep doing it. More. Lots more, Grandpa said. I sent a storm of smoke clouds over the frames. The fumes had a wet cigar smell that tricked the bees into thinking that their hive was on fire, sending them down into the hive to gobble honey before they fled their burning home. With full stomachs, Grandpa said, it made it harder for them to bend their bodies into stinging position. When I had smoked most of the bees off the top bars of the hive, he lifted a second frame out. Grandpa worked barehanded because he said he'd been stung so much it didn't bother him anymore. He swore all that venom prevented his joints from stiffening up with arthritis, like Granny's. He inspected 2 more frames, returned them to the box, and lifted out another. Then he bent down on one knee and held the frame out to me so I could see. "Look here, where I'm pointing." I let out a small gasp. The queen was so obviously the queen. She was elegantly tapered, twice the size of all the other bees, and with longer legs that looked like they belonged on a spider. Her abdomen was so heavy with eggs that it dragged behind her as she walked. Like bodyguards parting a crowd for a pop star, an entourage of bees formed a protective circle around her and cleared a path as she moved. She rushed across the honeycomb like she was late for something. Her royalty was apparent in the way the other bees grew visibly excited when she came near, rushing up to caress her with their antennae, some even wrapping their forearms around her head in what looked like an embrace. The only word for their behavior was worship. "Why do they touch her like that?" "They're gathering her special scent and passing it to the rest of the bees," Grandpa said. "That's how they know which hive is theirs." Every queen has her own smell. Her daughters never forget it. It's true, mothers have an aroma. Mine smelled like Charlie perfume and Vantage cigarettes, mixed with the faint musk of other people's clothes from the church thrift shop. It was a unique scent that I recognized instantly whenever I climbed into the bed we shared. I thought of Mom at that moment, passing the hours under the covers. I wish she could see this queen, how an insect was so perfectly designed to be a mother, how the queen was the heartbeat of a whole stunning society operating right under our noses. The queen padded along the honeycomb with the impatience of the very pregnant. She seemed to be weary of all the attention, refusing to slow down for every bee that wanted to touch her, as she single-mindedly searched for something. Every few steps, she ducked her head into one of the honeycomb cells, then retreated. She checked chamber after chamber, hunting. I asked Grandpa what she was looking for. "Good spot to lay an egg," he said. "Gotta be clean, well-built. Can't have an egg already in there." She was picky about her nursery, but finally she found a space to her liking and backed her abdomen into it. As she crouched there for a second, her attendant bees came in close as if to tell her a secret. The queen then did a little push-up with her legs and exited. I peered at the hexagon cell where she'd just been and spied a white pin inside, like a miniature grain of rice, standing on end, perfectly centered on the back wall. Two nurse bees dipped their head into the cell to verify her work. I had never seen anything born before and realized I'd just seen my first miracle.
Thank you so much. That was Meredith May reading from The Honey Bus, a memoir of loss, courage, and a girl saved by bees. So when did your parents' difficulties come into the idea of the memoir? Because the prologue begins with your grandfather with bees, and then the first chapter begins with a pepper grinder flying across the kitchen.
This memoir took me a decade to write because at first I wasn't quite sure what I was writing. It was more, the first version was very much about my family and my parents and their difficulties and not so much about bees. And I think I wasn't quite mature enough to know what I was writing when I began, and it took a lot of soul-searching and forgiveness and interviewing my parents about their background to understand how to put it together. So it began front and center. I remember I went to a low-residency MFA program, Goucher College in Maryland, and it worked for me because I was working at the Chronicle and I couldn't take a lot of time off, so you only had to be there for a few weeks out of the year. But I had interest from an agent from one of my newspaper stories, and we had a book proposal in, and I thought, oh, well, this is great. I'll just get my MFA, and at the same time, the work I have to do for the MFA will be my book. And I was very sort of confident that this was all going to work out just great. And I found out the day I arrived at Goucher that that book project wasn't going to go forward. And my teacher said, okay, come to the next class with pages to workshop. And I literally said, workshop, isn't that a noun? Like, I didn't know what he meant. I was such a journalist. I was not in the literary world. And I had to ask one of the students in my class who was a New York Times bestseller, what does he mean, workshop? And so I sat down that night, and I think the first sentence I wrote is, I don't know who threw it, you know, about the pepper grinder.
Yes.
And so I started out just kind of getting these family emotions out on paper.
And then the prologue, did that come later? Did you write the book and then figure it needed a prologue to put us into the B world?
Yes, that was my wise editor, Erica Amirani at Park Row Books. She could see, you know, by the time this book is what it became, the bees were a much, much bigger part. And, you know, as we were going through edits, the first manuscript I turned into her did start with the family fight, and it really became a book about sort of the moral necessity of bees and the ancient wisdom of bees, not so much about a divorce, because, hey, how many of us
right.
have had that happen?
Right,
you know,
right.
that's not interesting. It was therapeutic for me, and I think it was a first step for me in trying to organize my thoughts. But, yeah, then we went back and said, okay, we need to set the tone of this book of what it is.
Mm-hmm. Well, I love how throughout the book you relate sort of the way bees work together to how your family does not work together, or a beehive, I should say. Talk a little bit about that. I found that really poignant. I think it, especially on 180, I made a note that 180 something happens. Now I have to look.
Oh, now you're making me look.
yeah, I think it was just, you know, your parents and your granny are locked into this war, and
yeah.
You're just being torn apart, and you're going, this isn't how bees do it.
Yeah, I guess to explain to listeners who haven't read the book, when I was living in Rhode Island, I was about 5, my brother was about 3, and my parents split. My mom was super volatile, and we got on a plane with my mom, and when the plane landed, we were in California, and we were moving back into my mom's childhood bedroom in my grandparents' house. So the 3 of us shared a bedroom for, I think, a decade or so.
And that was in the Carmel Valley?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep, in Carmel Valley.
Okay.
And my grandmother, my mother stayed in bed for most of that time, and my grandmother sort of, I guess, nursed her is the best way to say it, but, you know, indulged her. And my mother became like my older sister. She just sort of tolerated us, but most of the time our job was to not bother her. And when I was with my grandpa in the bee yard watching a bee colony and how they interact, I would see the exact opposite of that. And I can give you an example. One time grandpa and I were beekeeping, and rain snuck up on us, and you never want to open a hive in the rain because bees really get fussy. They don't like that. So we were hurrying to put it back together, and he had a frame in his hands, and he said, oh my God, look at this. And it was a frame from the nursery, so there were eggs in it, and there were nurse bees on it. And all of a sudden, they snapped into formation. They lined up all facing the same way, all with their heads up over the eggs, and they interlocked their wings. It looked like Spanish roof tiles, and they made a tarp, and they were protecting the eggs from the rain. And it was spooky because we looked away for just a second and then looked back at the frame, and we were thinking, like, how did they send the signal out all at once to do this? How did they know to do this? But then the beautiful thing about it is that they were putting themselves in harm's way for their babies. You know, because if we hadn't put that frame back and left them out in the rain or the cold, they would have died, those nurse bees. But they would have stayed up there trying to protect the next generation for as long as they could. So the opposite of that was happening in my house. In my house, everything was about mom, her needs, being quiet, not upsetting her, giving her space, never mentioning my father because that upset her. So we didn't really understand why dad wasn't there, and we weren't allowed to have our own feelings about that publicly. So that's how the bees and then my home life were exact opposites of each other. And I sensed something comforting about the bees, but I couldn't put this into words as a child, obviously. It wasn't until I got to be close to 50, close to Grandpa's age, when I showed up on his door, that I started realizing all these connections.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And gee, I mean, your mother spent a lot or most of your childhood in bed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she did. my mom, I found out later as an adult, was horribly physically and emotionally abused by her own father. So her spirit was broken. Her self-love was broken at a very young age. She told me that he would chase her with a switch, a branch from a tree, and hit her with it all the time. And he would actually make her go and find the switch or choose the switch, you know, choose her torture implement. She said this began at three and lasted all the way until she finally left for college. And so I can't even imagine. So I say that just to sort of lay the foundation first for why she may have completely tumbled when her marriage fell apart. I think in her mind, she was going to start a new life. I mean, she met my father in college. So she'd only been out of the house a few years, and this was her do-over, and my father's dashing, and he's in the Navy, and he was traveling the world because of that. And I think, you know, I'm inferring a lot, but I think that she was hoping for a whole new glamorous life. And when it didn't work out, it was just confirmation that nothing good will ever happen for her. And she just really couldn't get out of bed. And she would read a lot. She read a lot of astrology books. She wanted to try to figure out her fate and why her luck wasn't happening for her. She was just trying to figure out, unlock the mysteries of her divorce and her life. So she became a big astrology fan, and she played Ouija a lot. And I think my grandmother took care of her because my grandmother felt guilty about her childhood. So this was like a second chance for my grandmother to make amends. Mm-hmm. But it just kind of made a toxic environment for the kids.
And just to be clear, so your grandfather, the beekeeper, is your step-grandfather, not the one that
Correct.
Tortured your mom.
Oh, yes. Thank you for doing that. It's so familiar to me, I forget to make that very important distinction. The man I call Grandpa is Granny's second husband. They got married when they were 40. They met square dancing. So, but my grandmother's first husband, you know, they had a terrible relationship, obviously, and they had a divorce. And so my grandmother and my mother would kvetch about men all the time. So I sort of grew up with men are worthless, you know, don't get married, or just this really negativity towards men, and my father in particular. They spoke terribly of him. And when I was little, I was a little afraid of him because I didn't know what to believe.
And then you visit him, your mother and you and your brother visit her father. That chapter was such a visceral, memorable section in this book. I still remember their furniture.
Oh, yeah. Occasionally, Mom would pop out of bed, and you never knew what was going to happen, which mom was going to come out of the room. You know, sometimes it was this really pumped-up, animated one who would take you places, garage sales mostly, and buy you trinkets. Or the angry one would come out, and that was scary. But one of the times she popped out, she took us right to her father's house. This was a Christmas visit in Carmel. And it was very confusing because she told us we were going to see our grandfather, and I said, but I have one. I didn't understand why I would have two. And that chapter you talk about is when we go into this, it's like a modern architectural design home in Carmel with floating staircases. And I just remember being so confused. But I sensed something was off, even at that age, with her and her father, because it was icy. It reminds me of that movie Ice Storm. Mm. You know that house in the movie? It's all glass and poured cement, and there's always a storm going on. It had that feel to it, the house. It was just cold, and our footsteps echoed when we walked in it. And Mom was on edge, and I didn't know why, and this man was frowning, and I didn't know why. And, you know, that's the one, I think the only scene or chapter, scene, I'll say, in the book that I just wrote once. Everything else is probably rewritten. I wrote the book three times, start to finish. But that's the one that just, it came out clean, and it's never happened before or since.
Why do you think that is?
It must have left an indelible impression on me. Maybe also because it was like the first time I'd been taken out of my world and my world in Carmel Valley, I should say, and had a peek at what made my mom the way she was. And so it's seared in my brain.
You are listening to Writers on Writing. I am with Meredith May. Her book is The Honey Bus, a memoir of loss, courage, and a girl saved by bees. And if you just tuned in, this show, along with many, many others, will be podcast. You could go to iTunes, subscribe to Writers on Writing, and when it is podcast in a few days, hopefully, it will land in your infile, and you can listen from the start. Earlier, you said something to the effect of when you're talking about your mom in bed and maybe why she spent so much time there. You said you were inferring about her because obviously you couldn't really know. Yet, when you write a memoir, there's an awful lot of inferring that kind of has to happen, right?
Exactly. I mean, it was tricky for me coming from journalism where, first of all, you never say I or me, and then you never tell people what you think. It was very tricky for me to write this, and there were also three different voices in it, the child me who doesn't know what's going on, and then the adult me who now does. And so And then, you know, sort of the beekeeper me who's telling you, you know, cool facts about bees. So what you just said is probably the hardest part of this book for me, was figuring out when to write the scene in child mind and when to jump in as the adult and reflect on it, mm-hmm. and to do it in a way that left enough to the imagination so you, the reader, are getting mentally stimulated and figuring it out for yourself and interpreting it for yourself. And in some cases, I was a precocious child, and I think children who are in families like this are forced to grow up quickly. And because my brother and I were so silenced emotionally, I did a lot of heavy just thinking about things. And so in some cases, I'm writing as a kid, but I'm having pretty mature thoughts. And I think that can be tricky as well, because readers may say things like, how could she remember that? Or how does she have that kind of thought about that? So it was a real difficult balance trying to get that aspect of this book right.
Well, I think you got it right, because, when the book landed at my front door, I remember looking at it and thinking, oh, I don't want to read a whole book from a child's point of view. I just don't want to. It's like mm-hmm. one of my things right now. It's like, no more. And mm-hmm. and this wasn't like that. It was balanced so wonderfully that I never felt like it was a chore, because I had to deal with a child's point of view, that you were always sort of bringing language and imagery and your chops as a writer, as a journalist, as a memoirist to the project. And I loved it. Okay. I've said that before.
I appreciate that so much, because I said earlier I wrote it three times. I'm not exaggerating. I rewrote this book three times, and the first time was child voice. I was trying to mimic Mary Carr, because I thought, I loved that memoir and I want mine to be like her. And it just wasn't working. And my editor said, we need the adult narrative. Mm-hmm. We need to know what you think about what happened to you. Otherwise it's all telling.
Right.
And you have to help the reader. The reader wants to know if you're wounded, if you're at peace, if you're conflicted. They want help, not so that you're telling them what to think, but they need to know where you are. And I think that's what you were just saying. Like, when it's all from a child, sometimes it can come off one-dimensional.
Yeah, I was going to say, in that point of view, the story often lacks the depth that you can give it when you bring in sort of the adult reflecting.
Mm-hmm. And I worried it would be confusing. But that's just my newness to this genre.
Hmm. So when you say you rewrote it three times, talk a little bit about that. I mean, did the rewriting mean that you tweaked each previous version? Did it mean that you put it aside and started over? How did that go for you?
Version one was child voice. Version two was go back and add adult reflection. And that was started out as tweaking. And then I realized, if I'm putting in adult reflection, I need different scenes. Like, I got different ideas about what should stay and what should go. Oh, also, the first version went from age 5 to age 40. That's the other mistake I made, that I didn't really catch on that a memoir is typically a slice in time. It's not an autobiography. So version two went from age 5 to about where it is now, which is like 17, 18, with adult reflection and some different scenes. So it started out as tweaking, and then it ended up being pretty much 75% rewrite. And then Grandpa passed away, and I became a full-time beekeeper. I'm not full-time as a job, but I got bees again. And then when that happened, I started remembering so much about my grandfather and being so grateful instead of so anxiety-ridden about my childhood, I started remembering more things. And when I realized the book needed to be about my being saved, not my bad luck, that's the third version I could pretty much completely rewrote. I mean, I kept the bones of it, but the tone of everything had to change. So I, like, flushed through everything and rewrote it.
Hmm. Yes.
I'm glad no one saw the first version. They were very scratchy.
But, you know, what you're talking about is how I think most writers should feel, most of us should feel and should do, which is practice patience, you know, with the work and work on it until it's ready, as opposed to our need to get something out there right away. You know, we want it to be right away. We want to see the book. So, you know, if it doesn't happen fast enough, we publish it ourselves and we, you know, go through all sorts of contortions trying to perhaps put something out there when it's just not time yet.
Right. And also with each year that goes by that you're working on something, you think, oh, this is starting to take so long, that must mean that it's doomed. You know, like you put a negativity to time as if that means is an indication of anything.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not. It's just it's going to be what it's going to be. The first book I wrote that you mentioned, I Who Did Not Die, that book I wrote in 5 months because it was a memoir of another person that I was ghostwriting. And I should probably talk about that a little bit because that book also helped me figure out what was wrong with my memoir and how to fix it.
Yeah.
It's an interesting story. My agent had sent out the Honey Bus to several editors, and this was 2016. And we had a lot of nibbles, but no bites. And I was very, very sad. This was version two of the book, actually. And then 6 months later, one of the nibbles sort of boomeranged back, and they said, look, we're looking for a ghostwriter to write the story of this Iranian child soldier during the Iran-Iraq War. And I had done a little reporting in the Middle East at the Chronicle, so they thought I might be a good fit. And it ended up being the most amazing story. It was about a 12-year-old boy who was the Iranian soldier who had been ordered to go into underground bunkers after a battle and shoot anyone still alive. He only found one man and a wounded Iraqi, and he couldn't bring himself to shoot him. So he built a wall of corpses and dragged the injured man behind it and hid him and nursed him back to health over 3 days. And they went their separate ways. Both were captured. Both were prisoners of war. And then 20 years later, by chance, they sit down next to each other in a help center for torture survivors in Vancouver, Canada. And it was just this unbelievable story about karma and mercy and, you know, the insanity of war. And it was a really amazing experience to meet these two men and write their stories, and it put my own victimhood in perspective. And it made me think about Grandpa and everything he taught me about unconditional love and stewardship of nature. And I realized, you know what? That's what's missing from the Honey Bus. It needs a higher calling. Besides, it's just, this is a story of what happened to me. So I was so upset and sad when no editors could took the honey bus on the first time we tried to sell it, but I'm now so glad they didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And I had this other experience that informed me and just deepened everything about me.
Hmm. Yeah, yeah. It's interesting how that happens, and you know, when it's ready, when it's not yet ready. But there, you know, we haven't talked about bees very much.
Let's do it.
Let's talk about bees, because there were things I did not know about bees, and I do love honeybees, and when I'm in near a swimming pool and a bee lands in a swimming pool, my family and I have to rescue those bees because, you know, bees are in trouble. And I think, you know, one of the things that came through, especially for people that don't know much about bees, is that, you know, you say something like these insects, actually this is the exact sentence, these insects that made most people run in fear were the invisible glue of the earth that held us all together. And I love that because, you know, so many people are afraid of bees, and yet people forget that without bees, we'd basically have no food.
Mm-hmm. I love talking to little kids about bees because, you know, I always start out with like, well, okay, why are bees special? And they always say, honey. But bees pollinate a third of all crops grown on the planet. So I show the kids a picture of the grocery store, current time, and then there's this slide you can show next to it that shows all the fruits and vegetables that would be gone if there were no bees, and it just looks like a beige wasteland.
Mm-hmm.
And then they get it. Marla Spivak, if I'm saying her name right, has this great YouTube video about why bees are disappearing, and she does that. And so that's where I got that idea with those two slides. You see it next to each other, and it's dark. You know, bees are struggling right now. And, you know, I get asked that question almost on the daily, like, how are the bees? What should we do about the bees? And there are actually a lot of things you can do, civilians can do. You don't have to become a beekeeper to help them. And the one thing is the easiest and actually the most beneficial is just to plant wildflowers.
Mm-hmm.
Because it sounds like it's a little not enough, but we've created a food desert because we've paved over most of the wildflower meadows, and in our monocrops have created these mono diets for bees, and they need a diversity to stay healthy. So I always bring those little seed balls when I talk to people, and they can just toss those in their gardens. And we need to put wildflowers everywhere on roofs and medians. And if farmers would use them as crop borders, that would help.
Mm-hmm.
It's a simple, but it's super, super helpful.
Mm. Well, as you were saying that, I made a note to myself to plant more flowers because it seems like we have some, but maybe not enough. Maybe the butterflies love the garden because we have a lot of milkweed, but I think we need more flowers for the bees. And something else I learned about bees was about the matriarchy. You talked about the queen bee at the beginning of the show, but you know, the matriarchy, and then there are step bees and step grandpas. I mean, I had no idea.
Yeah, a lot of people don't know this, that a hive is a female place. A typical bee colony will have about 50,000 bees. It can get up to 80 or 90,000 bees, and 90% of them are female. The rest are male drones. And drones have one job, and that's to mate with a virgin queen. But most drones never get the chance to do it in their lifetime because queens can live up to 4 or 5 years. So male drone bees really just hang out in the hive and beg for food. That's basically what you're going to do if you were born male and you're a honeybee. So every bee you see on a flower gathering nectar, pollen, female. All the guard bees, nurse bees, janitor bees, undertaker bees, construction worker bees, wax maker bees, the queen's attendants, everyone, females, are doing the work. So this comes back to bite the men every winter, because you'll come outside your hive as soon as the temperature starts dropping, and you'll see a lot of dead drones on the ground, and the women push them out because there are too many mouths to feed over winter, and the queen will just make more men in the following year. So it's if you're going to be a bee, you want to be female.
And beehives are rented out.
Yeah, I think you're talking about large commercial beekeepers.
Mm-hmm.
The way they make their money is not on the honey. It's on renting their hives during the bloom, and they rent them to large-scale agricultural farms. So, for example, in California, there are not enough bees to pollinate all the almond trees in the Central Valley. So beekeepers all over the country put their hives on semi-trucks and drive them to the Central Valley and put them down for a month or so. And then once that is pollinated, they put them back on the truck, and they'll just keep following the bloom. You know, maybe they'll go to Washington for the apples and swing back around for different crops and blueberries in Maine. So your typical bee in the United States lives on a truck. It doesn't live in nature.
What do you think about that?
I hold my grandpa's view on that, which is it's unnatural and driven by human greed, and it will come back to bite us in the end. I think that's one of the factors of why the bees are in trouble right now. It's unnatural for a couple of reasons, because the farms are sprayed with pesticide, and the bees bring trace amounts of it back into their hives with them. And while it may not kill them immediately, they incorporate it into the architecture of their wax. And it's like living in a home with lead-based paint.
Mm-hmm.
It might not get you, but maybe your child, all of a sudden you have a neurological problem and you don't know why and you can't trace it to anything. Also, some of the pesticides that have been deemed bee safe, when you combine them with another bee safe pesticide, it creates a toxic soup that is not bee safe.
Mm-hmm.
And then the mono diet. Like, can you imagine if you were forced to eat a hamburger every day for a month, and then a hot dog every day for a month, and then a piece of pizza every day for a month? Like, you'd get sick too. So it's disruptive. At the same time, I'm not going to tell commercial beekeepers you can't make a living, you know. But I'm thinking there's got to be a way where we can have hives permanently on farms and not truck them, and like find a different pay system where the hives stay and it's the beekeepers who move around. And that would require more organic farming, obviously. So it's a really difficult one, but there are a lot of people coming together and talking about this. And there's something called the Bee Informed Partnership. That's a really great sort of agnostic collection of farmers and beekeepers and scientists and activists, you know, all trying to figure this out. So that's encouraging.
Hmm. We have a few minutes left with Meredith May. Her book is The Honey Bus. I have to say something about your book trailer on your website. It's so lovely and so moving, and I loved seeing your grandfather in action. Yeah, what a great book trailer. Are you happy with it?
I'm thrilled with it. I teach podcasting at Mills College in Oakland, and my teaching assistant put that together for me, Jesse Rosen. And I love what he did with it. He made it like a movie book mm-hmm. trailer. It was, you know, and he's really good with video, and he's really good with sound. He went to the San Francisco Academy of Art, mm-hmm. and it's coincidentally, he's also from Big Sur, so we just really clicked artistically, and yes, I love it. I think it's totally great. And the footage in there is of my grandfather inside the honey bus, showing me something. I think he's showing me the holding tanks and talking to me. And that is old footage I took. I just happened to take it with a flip camera. They don't even make them anymore. Mm-hmm. But at the Chronicle, passed them all out and wanted us to start practicing with them to take video for our stories when the San Francisco Chronicle, the SF Gate website was coming up. They were trying to get us digitized. And so I was just messing around, and I kept that footage, thank goodness.
Well, you know, there's so much more to talk about, and hopefully we'll get you down here late summer or early fall to do a speaker series event. But, you know, I wanted to ask you about something I heard a long time ago, and that was if you have at least one person in your childhood that gives you a sense of worth, you'll be okay. And I wonder mm-hmm. if your grandfather was that person for you.
Oh, yes. That sounds like something I would have said. Definitely. I mean, and I hit the grandpa jackpot. He is such a grounded person, and so beloved. And what I've learned from that is the only thing that matters in life is your connections with other people. When I go to Big Sur, if I tell people, I usually introduce myself as Franklin Pierce's granddaughter because that gets me like instant access and love. And, you know, he is a legend down there. And that's taught me, I think, more than anything in my life is to see the outpouring of affection for this, you know, very sort of mild, quiet beekeeper.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Have you always been a journalist? Was there ever a question of whether you'd be a poet or a fiction writer?
Always a journalist. I'm laughing. When I was a real little kid, like second grade, I used to rewrite my children's books. I got in a little trouble because I wouldn't go out for recess, and I would rewrite. I thought they were too saccharine, and I would like twist the plots and make the ending sad instead of happy, which that tells you something right there. But so I think I dabbled in fiction as a really, really young kid. But I went into journalism because, well, my grandmother, bless her heart, wrote a letter to the Carmel Pinecone when I was in high school, offering to write for free, to write a youth column, and surprise, I got the job. And so she told me this after the fact. And so then I had deadlines, and I think I loved seeing my name in print, and I loved writing. And ever since high school, I wanted to work at the San Francisco Chronicle. I used to write fan letters to the reporters.
That's great. That's right along the lines of what Carolyn C. used to say to everybody, which is, you know, write a charming note. Just every day, write a charming note.
Mm-hmm. You know? I applied to the Chronicle for like 5 or 6 years in a row. There wasn't an opening. I just kept sending them a letter saying, I'd really love to work for you. And I think I just finally wore them down.
Well, you know, it kind of goes along with what we do as writers, which is you have to send your stuff out. And, you know, yeah, you're going to get no's along the way, you may get a ton of no's, but if you don't do it, you're telling yourself no. So, make a choice here. You have to do it, right?
Oh, I love that. You're telling yourself no. Oh, I'm going to steal that. Thank you.
You're welcome.
What I usually say, no just means not right now. It doesn't mean no forever.
Yeah.
I think that's the only difference between someone who feels they're frustrated as a writer and someone who got published is that the person who got published just got off the ground more times. You know, it's not that they're necessarily a better writer. It's just you have this steel body armor when it comes to the word no.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm also thinking about Dennis Palumbo, who is a writer and therapist to creatives in LA, and he says, keep giving them you until you is who they want. You know, it's like, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. See, it's also nice to hear other people come up with things about this, to like positive affirmations.
Oh, I'm so sorry. We're at the end of our time. Do you have any little tips, advice, words of wisdom for the memoirist listening?
Yeah, your story matters, and no one's going to write it the way you're going to write it, and a lot of people are going to give you their opinion about it before you're even finished with it, and you just really have to shut the door, unplug the phone, and do what you want to do, and let other people say what they're going to say, but honor yourself.
And on that note, we will thank you for being here, and be lovely to have you down here in a few months. So maybe, hopefully, that'll work.
Well, you're going to do it. We will. We'll
great.
Make it happen.
Thank you so much, Meredith.
Thank you. This has been really lovely. I appreciate your careful read and all your questions.
Oh, well, I loved your book. And that is the truth. And on that note, we are going to go. And you've been listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. This podcast will join the others on iTunes. Search out Writers on Writing. Subscribe if you are so kind as to leave a review so that others might easily find it, or more easily find it. Please do. In the meantime, you writers out there, stay in the chair.